Lord Eddard has been imprisoned. He's charged with treason. It is said he plotted with Robert's brothers to deny the throne to Prince Joffrey.
No, John said at once, that couldn't be. My father would never betray the king.
Be that as it may, said Mormont. It's not for me to say, nor for you.
But it's a lie, John insisted. How could they think his father was a traitor? Had they all gone mad?
Lord Eddard Stark would never dishonor himself.
Would he?
He fathered a bastard, a small voice whispered beside him. Where was the honor in that? And your mother? What of her? He will not even speak her name.
My lord, what will happen to him? Will they kill him?
Well, as to that, I cannot say, lad. I mean to send a letter. I knew some of the king's counsellors in my youth. Old Pycelle, Lord Stannis, Sir Barristan. Whatever your father has done, or hasn't done, he is a great lord. He must be allowed to take the black and join his heir. Gods know we need men of Lord Eddard's ability.
John knew that other men accused of treason had been allowed to redeem their honour on the wall in days past. Why not Lord Eddard, his father here? That was a strange thought, and strangely uncomfortable. It would be a monstrous injustice to strip him of Winterfell and force him to take the black. And yet, if it meant his life, and would Joffrey allow it? He remembered the prince at Winterfell, the way he'd mocked Rob and Sir Roderick in the yard. John himself he had scarcely even noticed. Bastards were beneath even his contempt. My lord, will the king listen to you? The old bear shrugged.
The boy king. I imagine he listened to his mother. Pity the dwarf isn't with them. He's the lad's uncle, and he saw our need when he visited us. It was a bad thing. Your lady mother taking him captive.
Lady Stark is not my mother, John reminded him sharply. Tyrion Lannister had been a friend to him. If Lord Eddard was killed, she would be as much to blame as a queen. My lord, what of my sisters, Arya and Sansa? They were with my father. Do you know...
Pycelle makes no mention of them, but Dr. Selby treated gently. I will ask about them when I write.
Mormont shook his head.
This could not have happened at a worse time, if ever the realm needed a strong king. There are dark days and cold nights ahead. I feel it in my bones.
He gave John a long, shrewd look.
I hope you're not thinking of doing anything stupid, boy.
He's my father, John wanted to say,
but he knew that Mormont would not want to hear it. His throat was dry. He made himself take another sip of wine.
Your duty is here now, the Lord Commander reminded him. Your old life ended when you took the black.
His bird made a raucous echo.
Blah!
Mormont took no notice.
Whatever they do in King's Landing is none of our concern.
When John did not answer, the old man finished his wine and said,
You're free to go. I'll have no further need of you today. On the morrow, you can help me write that letter.
John did not remember standing or leaving the solar. The next he knew, he was descending the tower steps thinking, This is my father, my sister. How can it be none of my concern? Outside, one of the guards looked at him and said,
Be strong, boy. The guards are cruel.
They know, John realized.
My father is no traitor, he said hoarsely.
Even the words stuck in his throat as if to choke him. The wind was rising, and it seemed colder in the yard than it had when he'd gone in. Spirit summer was drawing to an end. The rest of the afternoon passed as if in a dream. John could not have said where he walked, what he did, who he spoke with. Ghost was with him. He knew that much. The silent presence of the dire wolf gave him comfort. The girls do not even have that much, he thought. Their walls might have kept them safe. But Lady is dead, and Nymeria is lost. They're all alone. A north wind had begun to blow by the time the sun went down. John could hear it skirling against the wall and over the icy battlements as he went to the common hall for the evening meal. Hob had cooked up a venison stew, thick with barley, onions and carrots. When he spooned an extra portion onto John's plate and gave him the crusty heel of the bread, he knew what it meant.
He knows.
He looked around the hall. Saw heads turned quickly, eyes politely averted.
They all know.
His friends rallied to him.
"We asked the Septon to light a candle for your father,"
Mather told him.
"It's a lie. We all know it's a lie. Even Gren knows it's a lie,"
Pip chimed in. Gren nodded, and Sam clasped John's hand.
"You're my brother now, so he's my father, too," the fat boy said. "If you want to go out to the weirwoods and pray to the old gods, I'll go with you."
The weirwoods were beyond the wall. Yet he knew Sam meant what he said.
"They are my brothers," he thought, "as much as Rob and Bran and Rickon."
And then he heard the laughter, sharp and cruel as a whip, and the voice of Sir Alistair Thorne.
"Not only a bastard, but a traitor's bastard,"
he was telling the men around him. In the blink of an eye, John had vaulted onto the table, dagger in his hand. Pip made a grab for him, but he wrenched his leg away, and then he was sprinting down the table and kicking the bowl from Sir Alice's hand. Stew went flying everywhere, spattering the brothers. Thorne recoiled. People were shouting, but Jon Snow did not hear them. He lunged at Sir Alice's face with a dagger, slashing at those cold onyx eyes. But Sam threw himself between them, and before Jon could get around him, Pip was on his back, clinging like a monkey. And Gren was grabbing his arm while Toad wrenched the knife from his fingers. Later, much later, after they had marched him back to his sleeping cell, Mormont came down to see him, Raven on his shoulder.
"I told you not to do anything stupid, boy," the old bear said.
"Oi!"
the bird chorused. Mormont shook his head, disgusted.
"And to think I had high hopes for you."
They took his knife and his sword and told him he was not to leave his cell until the high officers met to decide what was to be done with him. And then they placed a guard outside his door to make certain he obeyed. His friends were not allowed to see him, but the old bear did relent and permit him ghost, so he was not utterly alone.
"My father is no traitor,"
he told the direwolf when the rest had gone. Ghost looked at him in silence. John slumped against the wall, hands around his knees, and stared at the candle on the table beside his narrow bed. The flame flickered and swayed. The shadows moved around him. The room seemed to grow darker and colder.
"I will not sleep tonight," John thought.
Yet he must have dozed. When he woke, his legs were stiff and cramped, and the candle had long since burned out. Ghost stood on his hind legs, scrabbling at the door. John was startled to see how tall he'd grown.
"Ghost, what is it?" he called softly.
The direwolf turned his head and looked down at him, baring his fangs in a silent snarl.
"Has he gone mad?" John wondered.
"It's me, Ghost," he murmured, trying not to sound afraid. Yet he was trembling violently.
When had it gotten so cold?
Ghost backed away from the door. There were deep gouges where he'd rake the wood. John watched him with mounting disquiet.
"There's someone out there, isn't there?" he whispered.
Crouching, the dire wolf crept backward, white fur rising on the back of his neck.
"The guard," he thought. "They left a man to guard my door. Ghost smells him through the door. That's all it is."
Slowly, John pushed himself to his feet. He was shivering, uncontrollably, wishing he still had a sword. Three quick steps brought him to the door. He grabbed the handle and pulled it inward. The creak of the hinges almost made him jump. His guard was sprawled bonelessly across the narrow steps, looking up at him. Looking up at him, even though he was lying on his stomach. His head had been twisted completely around.
"It can't be," John told himself. This is the Lord Commander's tower. It's guarded day and night. This couldn't happen. It's a dream. I'm having a nightmare.
Ghost slid past him out of the door. The wolf started up the steps, stopped, looked back at John. That was when he heard it. The soft scrape of a boot on stone. The sound of a latch turning. The sounds came from above, from the Lord Commander's chambers. A nightmare this might be, yet it was no dream. The guard's sword was in its sheath. John knelt and worked it free. The heft of steel in his fist made him bolder. He moved up the steps, ghost padding silently before him. Shadows lurked in every turn of the stair. John crept up wearily, probing any suspicious darkness with the point of his sword. Suddenly, he heard the shriek of Mormont's raven.
Gorn!
The bird was screaming.
Gorn! 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 Gorn!
Ghost bounded ahead, and John came scrambling after. The door to Mormont's solo was wide open. The direwolf plunged through. John stopped in the doorway, blade in hand, giving his eyes a moment to adjust. Heavy drapes had been pulled across the windows, and the darkness was black as ink. "Who's there?" he called out. Then he saw it, a shadow in the shadows, sliding towards the inner door that led to Mormont's sleeping cell. A man-shape, all in black, cloaked and hooded. But beneath the hood, the eyes shone with an icy blue radiance. Ghost leapt. Man and wolf went down together, with neither scream nor snarl, rolling, smashing into a chair, knocking over a table laden with papers. Mormont's raven was flapping overhead, screaming,
"Gorn! Gorn! Gorn! Gorn!"
John felt as blind as Maester Aemon. Keeping the wall to his back, he slid toward the window and ripped down the curtain. Moonlight flooded the solar. He glimpsed black hands buried in white fur, swollen dark fingers tightening around his direwolf's throat. Ghost was twisting and snapping, legs flailing in the air, but he could not break free. John had no time to be afraid. He threw himself forward, shouting, bringing down the longsword with all his weight behind it. Steel sheared through sleeve and skin and bone. Yet the sound was wrong somehow. The smell that engulfed him was so queer and cold he almost gagged. He saw arm and hand on the floor, black fingers wriggling in a pool of moonlight. Ghost wrenched free from the other hand and crept away, red tongue lolling from his mouth. The hooded man lifted his pale moon face, and John slashed at it without hesitation. The sword laid the intruder open to the bone, taking off half his nose and opening a gash cheek to cheek under those eyes. Eyes. Eyes like blue stars burning. John knew that face. Arthur, he thought, reeling back. Gods, he's dead, he's dead. I saw him dead. He felt something scrabble at his ankle. Black fingers clawed at his calf. The arm was crawling up his leg, ripping at wool and flesh. Shouting with revulsion, John pried the fingers off his leg with the point of his sword and flipped the thing away. It lay writhing, fingers opening and closing. The corpse lurched forward. There was no blood. One-armed, face cut near in half, it seemed to feel nothing. John held the longsword before him. "Stay away!" he commanded, his voice gone shrill.
"Gorn!" screamed the raven. "Gorn! Gorn!"
The severed arm was wriggling out of its torn sleeve, a pale snake with black, five-fingered head. Ghost pounced and got it between his teeth. Finger bones crunched. John hacked at the corpse's neck, felt the steel bite deep and hard. Dead Arthur slammed into him, knocking him off his feet. John's
Breath went out of him as the fallen table caught him between his shoulder blades. The sword! Where was the sword? It lost the damn sword!
When he opened his mouth to scream, the white jammed its black corpse fingers into John's mouth.
Gagging, he tried to shove it off,
but the dead man was too heavy, its hand forcing itself farther down his throat,
icy cold, choking him.
Its face was against his own, filling the world. Frost covered its eyes, sparkling blue. John raked cold flesh with his nails and kicked at the thing's legs. He tried to bite, tried to punch, tried to breathe. And suddenly, the corpse's weight was gone. Its fingers ripped from his throat. It was all John could do to roll over, retching and shaking. Ghost had it again. He watched as the direwolf buried his teeth in the white's gut and began to rip and tear. He watched, only half-conscious, for a long moment, before he finally remembered to look for his sword. And saw Lord Mormont, naked and groggy from sleep, standing in the doorway with an oil lamp in his hand. Gnawed and fingerless, the arm thrashed on the floor, wriggling toward him. John tried to shout, but his voice was gone. Staggering to his feet, he kicked the arm away and snatched the lamp from the old bear's fingers. The flame flickered and almost died.
"Burn!"
the raven called.
"Burn! Burn! Burn!"
Spinning, John saw the drapes he'd ripped from the window. He flung the lamp into the puddled cloth with both hands. Metal crunched, glass shattered, oil spewed, and the hangings went up in a great whoosh of flame. The heat of it on his face was sweeter than any kiss John had ever known.
"Ghost!" he shouted.
The direwolf wrenched free and came to him as the white struggled to rise, dark snakes spilling from the great wound in its belly. John plunged his hand into the flames, grabbed a fistful of the burning drapes, and whipped them at the dead man.
"Let it burn," he prayed, as the cloth smothered the corpse. "Gods, please, please let it burn."
Bran. The Karstarks came in on a cold, windy morning, bringing 300 horsemen and near 2,000 foot from their castle at Carhold. The steel points of their pikes winked in the pale sunlight as the column approached. A man went before them, pounding out a slow, deep-throated marching rhythm on a drum that was bigger than he was. Boom, boom, boom. Bran watched them come from a guard turret atop the outer wall, peering through Maester Lewin's bronze fire-eye while perched on Hoda's shoulders. Lord Rickard himself led them, his sons, Harion and Eddard and Torren, riding beside him beneath night-black banners emblazoned with the white sunburst of their house. Old Nan said they had Stark blood in them, going back hundreds of years, but they did not look like Starks to Bran. They were big men and fierce, faces covered with thick beards, hair worn loose past the shoulders. Their cloaks were made of skins, the pelts of bear and seal and wolf. They were the last, he knew. The other lords were already here, with their hosts. Bran yearned to ride out among them, to see the winter houses full to bursting, the jostling crowds in the market square every morning, the streets rutted and torn by wheel and hoof. But Rob had forbidden him to leave the castle. "We have no men to spare to guard you," his brother had explained.
"I'll take summer," Bran argued.
"Don't act the boy with me, Bran," Rob said. "You know better than that. Only 2 days ago, one of Lord Bolton's men knifed one of Lord Serwyn's at the Smoking Log."
"Our Lady Mother would skin me for a pelt if I let you put yourself at risk."
He was using the voice of Rob the Lord when he said it. Bran knew that meant there was no appeal. It was because of what had happened in the Wolf's Wood, he knew. The memory still gave him bad dreams. He had been as helpless as a baby, no more able to defend himself than Rickon would have been, less even. Rickon would have kicked them, at the least. It shamed him. He was only a few years younger than Rob. If his brother was almost a man grown, so was he. He should have been able to protect himself. A year ago, before, he would have visited the town even if it meant climbing over the walls by himself. In those days, he could run downstairs, get on and off his pony by himself, and wield a wooden sword good enough to knock Prince Tommen in the dirt. Now he could only watch, peering out through Maester Lewin's lens tube. The Maester had taught him all the banners, the male fist of the Glovers, silver on scarlet, Lady Mormont's black bear, the hideous flayed man that went before Roose Bolton of the Dreadfort, a bull moose for the Hornwoods, a battle axe for the Serwins, three sentinel trees for the Tallhearts, and the fearsome sigil of the House Umber, a roaring giant in shattered chains. And soon enough he learned their faces, too, when the lords and their sons and knights retainer came to Winterfell to feast. Even the great hall was not large enough to seat all of them at once. So Rob hosted each of the principal bannermen in turn. Bran was always given the place of honour at his brother's right hand. Some of the lord's bannermen gave him queer, hard stares as he sat there, as if they wondered by what right a green boy should be placed above them, and a cripple, too. "How many is it now?" Bran asked Maester Lewin, as Lord Carstark and his sons rode through the gates in the outer wall.
12,000 men, or near enough as makes no matter. How many knights? A few enough, the Maester said, with a touch of impatience. To be a knight, you must stand your vigil in a sept, and be anointed with the 7 oils to consecrate your vows. In the north, only a few of the great houses worship the 7. The rest honour the old gods, and name no knights. But those lords and their sons and sworn swords are no less fierce or loyal or honourable. A man's worth is not marked by a seer before his name, as I have told you 100 times before.
Still, said Bran, how many knights? Maester Lewin sighed.
300, perhaps 4, among 3,000 armoured lancers who are not knights.
Lord Carstark is the last, Bran said thoughtfully. Rob will feast him tonight.
No doubt he will.
How long before they go?
He must march soon, or not at all, Maester Lewin said. The winter town is full to bursting, and this army of his will eat the countryside clean, if it camps here much longer. Others are waiting to join him all along the King's Road, baron knights and Crannog men, and the Lords Manderley and Flint. The fighting has begun in the Riverlands, and your brother has many leagues to go.
I know. Bran felt as miserable as he sounded. He handed the bronze tube back to the Maester, and noticed how thin Lewin's hair had grown on top. He could see the pink of scalp showing through. It felt queer to look down on him this way, when he had spent his whole life looking up at him. But when you sat on Hodor's back, you looked down on everyone. "I don't want to watch any more, Hodor. Take me back to the keep."
"Hodor," said Hodor.
Maester Lewin tucked the tube up his sleeve.
"Bran, your lord brother will not have time to see you now. He must greet Lord Carstark and his sons and make them welcome."
"I won't trouble Rob. I want to visit the Godswood." He put his hand on Hodor's shoulder. "Hodor." A series of chisel-cut handholds made a ladder in the granite of the tower's inner wall. Hodor hummed tunelessly as he went down hand under hand, Bran bouncing against his back in the wicker seat that Maester Lewin had fashioned for him. Lewin had gotten the idea from the baskets the women used to carry firewood on their backs. After that, it had been a simple matter of cutting leg holes and attaching some new straps to spread Bran's weight more evenly. was not as good as riding Dancer, but there were places where Dancer could not go. And this did not shame Bran, the way it did when Hodor carried him in his arms like a baby. Hodor seemed to like it too, though with Hodor it was hard to tell. The only tricky part was Dawes. Sometimes Hodor forgot that he had Bran on his back, and that could be painful when he went through a door. For near a fortnight, there had been so many comings and goings that Robb ordered both portcullises kept up and the drawbridge down between them, even in the dead of night. A long column of armored lancers was crossing the moat between the walls when Bran emerged from the tower. Karstark men, following their lords into the castle. They wore black iron half-helms and black woolen cloaks patterned with a white sunburst. Hodor trotted along beside them, smiling to himself, his boots thudding against the wood of the drawbridge. The riders gave them queer looks as they went by, and once Bran heard someone guffaw, he refused to let it trouble him.
"Men will look at you."
Maester Lewin had warned him the first time they had strapped the wicker basket around Hodor's chest.
"They will look, and they will talk, and some will mock you."
Let them mock, Bran thought. No one mocked him in his bedchamber, but he would not live his life in bed.
As they passed beneath the gatehouse portcullis, Bran put two fingers into his mouth and whistled. Summer came loping across the yard. Suddenly the Karstark lancers were fighting for control as their horses rolled their eyes and whickered in dismay. One stallion reared, screaming, his rider cursing and hanging on desperately. The scent of direwolf sent horses into a frenzy of fear if they were not accustomed to it. But they'd quiet soon enough once summer was gone.
"The gods would," Bran reminded Hodor.
Even Winterfell itself was crowded. The yard rang to the sound of sword and axe, the rumble of wagons and the barking of dogs. The armory doors were open, and Bran glimpsed Micken at his forge, his hammer ringing as sweat dripped off his bare chest. Bran had never seen as many strangers in all his years, not even when King Robert had come to visit father. He tried not to flinch as Hodor ducked through a low door. They walked down a long, dim hallway, Summer padding easily beside them. The wolf glanced up from time to time, eyes smoldering like liquid gold. Bran would have liked to touch him, but he was riding too high for his hand to reach. The Godswood was an island of peace in the sea of chaos that Winterfell had become. Hodor made his way through the dense stands of oak and ironwood and sentinels to the still pool beside the heart tree. He stopped under the gnarled limbs of the weirwood, humming. Bran reached up over his head and pulled himself out of his seat, drawing the dead weight of his legs up through the holes in the wicker basket. He hung for a moment, dangling, the red, dark leaves brushing against his face, until Hodor lifted him and lowered him to the smooth stone beside the water. "I want to be by myself for a while," he said. "You go soak. Go to the pools."
"Hodor!"
Hodor stumped through the trees and vanished. Across the Godswood, beneath the windows of the guest house, an underground hot spring fed three small ponds. Steam rose from the water day and night, and the wall that loomed above was thick with moss. Hodor hated cold water, and would fight like a treed wildcat when threatened with soap, but he would happily immerse himself in the hottest pool and sit for hours, giving a loud burp to echo the spring whenever a bubble rose from the murky green depths to break upon the surface. Summer lapped at the water and settled down at Bran's side. He rubbed the wolf under the jaw, and for a moment boy and beast both felt at peace. Bran had always liked the Godswood, even before, but of late he found himself drawn to it more and more. Even the heart tree no longer scared him the way it used to. The deep red eyes carved into the pale trunk still watched him, Yet somehow he took comfort from that now. The guards were looking over him, he told himself. The old guards. Guards of the Starks, and the First Men, and the Children of the Forest, his father's guards. He felt safe in their sight, and the deep silence of the trees helped him think. Bran had been thinking a lot since his fall, thinking and dreaming and talking with the guards. "Please make it so Rob won't go away," he prayed softly. He moved his hands through the cold water, sending ripples across the pool. "Please make him stay. Or if he has to go, bring him home safe with Mother and Father and the girls. And make it so Rickon understands." His baby brother had been wild as a winter storm since he learned Rob was riding off to war, weeping and angry by turns. He'd refused to eat, cried, and screamed for most of the night, even punched old Nan when she tried to sing him to sleep. And the next day, he'd vanished. Rob had set half the castle searching for him, and when at last they found him, down in the crypts, Rickon had slashed at them with a rusted iron sword he'd snatched from a dead king's hand, and Shaggy Dog had come slavering out of the darkness like a green-eyed demon. The wolf was near as wild as Rickon. He'd bitten Gage on the arm and torn a chunk of flesh from Mickon's thigh. It had taken Rob himself and Grey Wind to bring him to bay. Tharlin had the black wolf chained up in the kennels now, and Rickon cried all the more for being without him. Maester Lewin counseled Rob to remain at Winterfell, and Bran pleaded with him too, for his own sake as much as Rickon's. But his brother only shook his head stubbornly and said, "I don't want to go. I have to." It was only half a lie. Someone had to go, to hold the Neck and help the Tullys against the Lannisters. Bran could understand that. But it did not have to be Rob. His brother might have given the command to Hal Mullen, or Theon Greyjoy, or to one of his lord's bannermen. Maester Lewin urged him to do just that, but Rob would not hear of it. "My lord father would never have sent men off to die while he huddled like a craven behind the walls of Winterfell," he said. "All Rob the Lord?" Rob seemed half a stranger to Bran now, transformed. A lord, in truth, though he had not yet seen his 16th name day. Even their father's bannerman seemed to sense it. Many tried to test him, each in his own way. Roose Bolton and Robert Glover both demanded the honour of battle command, the first brusquely, the second with a smile and a jest. Stark grey-haired Mage Mormont, dressed in mail like a man, told Rob bluntly that he was young enough to be her grandson and had no business giving her commands, but, as it happened, she had a granddaughter she would be willing to have him marry. Soft-spoken Lord Serwyn had actually brought his daughter with him, a plump, homely maid of 30 years who sat at her father's left hand and never lifted her eyes from her plate. Jovial Lord Hornwood had no daughters, but he did bring gifts. A horse one day, haunch of venison the next, a silver-chased hunting horn the day after, and he asked nothing in return. Nothing but a certain holdfast taken from his grandfather, and hunting rights north of a certain ridge, and leave to damn the White Knife, if it pleased the Lord. Rob answered each of them with cool courtesy, much as father might have. And somehow he bent them to his will. And when Lord Umber, who was called the Great John by his men, and stood as tall as Hodar and twice as wide, threatened to take his forces home if he was placed behind the Hornwoods or the Serwyns in the order of march, Rob told him he was welcome to do so. "And when we're done with the Lannisters," he promised, scratching Grey Wind behind the ear, "we will march back north, root you out of your keep, and hang you for an oathbreaker." Cursing, the Great John flung his flagon of ale into the fire and bellowed that Rob was so green he must piss grass. When Hallis Mullen moved to restrain him, He knocked him to the floor, kicked over a table, and unsheathed the biggest, ugliest greatsword that Bran had ever seen. All along the benches, his sons and brothers and sworn swords leapt to their feet, grabbing for their steel. Yet Rub only said a quiet word, and in a snarl, and the blink of an eye, Lord Umber was on his back, his sword spinning on the floor 3 feet away, and his hand dripping blood where Grey Wind had bitten off 2 fingers. My lord father taught me that it was death to bear steel against your liege lord, Rob said. But doubtless you only meant to cut my meat. Bran's bowels went to water as the great John struggled to rise, sucking at the red stumps of fingers. But then, astonishingly, the huge man laughed.
"Your meat," he roared, "is bloody tough."
And somehow, after that, the great John became Rub's right hand, his staunchest champion, loudly telling all and sundry that the boy lord was a Stark after all, and they damn well better bend their knees if they didn't fancy having them chewed off. Yet that very night, his brother came to Bran's bedchamber pale and shaken after the fires had burned low in the great hall. "I thought he was going to kill me," Rob confessed. "Did you see the way he threw down Hal, like he was no bigger than Rickon? Gods, I was so scared. And the great John's not the worst of them, only the loudest. Lord Roose never says a word. He only looks at me. And all I can think of is that room they have in the Dreadfort, where the Boltons hang the skins of their enemies." "That's just one of old Nan's stories," Bran said. A note of doubt crept into his voice. "Isn't it?"
"I don't know." He gave a weary shake of his head. "Lord Serwyn means to take his daughter south with us. To cook for him, he says. Theon is certain I'll find the girl in my bedroll one night. I wish father was here."
That was the one thing they could agree on. Bran and Rickon and Rob the Lord, they all wished father was here. But Lord Eddard was 1,000 leagues away, a captive in some dungeon, a hunted fugitive, running for his life, or even dead. No one seemed to know for certain. Every traveller told a different tale, each more terrifying than the last.
"The heads of Father's guardsmen were rotting on the walls of the Red Keep, impaled on spikes. Lord Robert was dead at Father's hands. The Baratheons had laid siege to King's Landing. Lord Eddard had fled south with the king's wicked brother, Renly. Arya and Sansa had been murdered by the Hound. Mother had killed off Tyrion the Imp and hung his body from the walls of Riverrun. Lord Tywin Lannister was marching on the Eyrie, burning and slaughtering as he went."
One wine-sodden tale-teller even claimed that Rhaegar Targaryen had returned from the dead and was marshalling a vast host of ancient heroes on Dragonstone to reclaim his father's throne. When the Raven came, bearing a letter marked with father's own seal and written in Sansa's hand, the cruel truth seemed no less incredible. Bran would never forget the look on Rob's face as he stared at their sister's words. "She says, Father conspired at treason with the king's brothers," he read. "King Robert is dead, and Mother and I are summoned to the Red Keep to swear fealty to Joffrey. She says we must be loyal, and when she marries Joffrey, she will plead with him to spare our lord father's life." His fingers closed into a fist, crushing Sansa's letter between them. "And she says nothing of Arya, nothing. Not so much as a word, damn her. What's wrong with the girl?" Bran felt all cold inside. "She lost her wolf," he said weakly, remembering the day when 4 of his father's guardsmen had returned from the south with Lady's bones. Summer and Grey Wind and Shaggy Dog had begun to howl before they crossed the drawbridge, in voices drawn and desolate. Beneath the shadow of the first keep was an ancient lich yard, its headstone spotted with pale lichen, where the old kings of winter had laid their faithful servants. It was there they buried Lady, while her brothers stalked between the graves like restless shadows. She had gone south, and only her bones had returned. Their grandfather, old Lord Rickard, had gone as well, with his son Brandon, who was father's brother, and 200 of his best men. None had ever returned. And father had gone south, with Arya and Sansa, and Jory and Holland, and Fat Tom, and the rest, and later mother and Sir Roderick had gone. And they hadn't come back either. And now Rob meant to go, not to King's Landing, and not to swear fealty, but to Riverrun with a sword in his hand. And if their lord father were truly a prisoner, that could mean his death for a certainty. It frightened Bran more than he could say. "If Rob has to go, watch over him," Bran entreated the old guards, as they watched him with the heart tree's red eyes, "and watch over his men, Hal and Quent and the rest, and Lord Umber and Lady Mormont and the other lords. And Theon, too, I suppose. Watch them and keep them safe, if it please you, gods. Help them defeat the Lannisters and save Father and bring them home." A faint wind sighed through the godswood, and the red leaves stirred and whispered. Summer bared his teeth.
"You hear them, boy?"
a voice asked. Bran lifted his head. Usher stood across the pool, beneath an ancient oak, her face shadowed by leaves. Even in irons, the wildlings moved quiet as a cat. Summer circled the pool, sniffed at her. The tall woman flinched. "Summer, to me," Bran called. The direwolf took one final sniff, spun, and bounded back. Bran wrapped his arm around him. "What are you doing here?" He had not seen Usher since they'd taken her captive in the wolf's wood, though he knew she'd been sent to working in the kitchen.
"They are my gods, too," Usher said. "Beyond the wall, they are the only gods."
Her hair was growing out, brown and shaggy. It made her look more womanly, that and the simple dress of brown roughspun they'd given her when they took her mail and leather.
"Gage lets me have my prayers from time to time, when I feel the need, and I let him do as he likes under my skirt when he feels the need. It's nothing to me. I like the smell of flour on his hands, and he's gentler than Steve."
She gave an awkward bow.
"I'll leave you. There's pots that want scouring."
"No, stay," Bran commanded her. "Tell me what you meant about hearing the gods." Usher studied him.
"You ask them, and they're answering. Open your ears. Listen. You'll hear."
Bran listened. "It's only the wind," he said after a moment, uncertain. "The leaves are rustling."
"Who do you think sends the wind, if not the gods?"
She seated herself across the pool from him, clinking faintly as she moved. Micken had fixed iron manacles to her ankles, with a heavy chain between them. She could walk, so long as she kept her strides small, but there was no way for her to run or climb or mount a horse.
"They see you, boy. They hear you talking. That rustling, that's them talking back."
"What are they saying?"
"They're sad. Your lord brother will get no help from them. Not where he's going. The old gods have no power in the south. The weirwoods there were all cut down thousands of years ago. How can they watch your brother when they have no eyes?"
Bran had not thought of that. It frightened him. If even the gods could not help his brother, what hope was there? Maybe Usher wasn't hearing them right. He cocked his head and tried to listen again.
He thought he could hear the sadness now, but nothing more than that.
The rustling grew louder. Bran heard muffled footsteps, and a low humming, and Hodor came blundering out of the trees, naked and smiling. "Hodor!" "He must have heard our voices," Bran said. "Hodor, you forgot your clothes." "Hodor!" Hodor agreed. He was dripping wet from the neck down, steaming in the chill air. His body was covered with brown hair, thick as a pelt. Between his legs, his manhood swung, long and heavy. Usher eyed him with a sour smile.
"Now there's a big man," she said. "He has giant's blood in him, or I'm the queen."
"Maester Lewin says there are no more giants. He said they're all dead, like the children of the forest. All that's left of them are old bones in the earth that men turn up with ploughs from time to time."
"Let Maester Lewin ride beyond the wall," Usher said. "He'll find giants then, or they'll find him. My brother killed one. 10 feet tall she was, and stunted at that. They've been known to grow big as 12 and 13 feet. Fierce things they are, too. All hair and teeth. And the wives have beards like their husbands, so there's no telling them apart. The women take human men for lovers, and it's from them the half-bloods come. It goes harder on the women they catch. The men are so big, they'll rip a maid apart before they get her with child." She grinned at him. "But you don't know what I mean, do you, boy?"
"Yes, I do," Bran insisted. He understood about mating. He had seen dogs in the yard and watched a stallion mount a mare. But talking about it made him uncomfortable. He looked at Hodor. "Go back and bring your clothes, Hodor," he said. "Go dress." "Hodor!" He walked back the way he had come, ducking under a low-hanging tree limb. He was awfully big, Bran thought, as he watched him go. "Are there truly giants beyond the wall?" he asked Usher, uncertainly.
"Giants, and worse than giants, Lordling. I tried to tell your brother when he asked his questions, him and your maester and that smiley boy Greyjoy. The cool winds are rising, and men go out from their fires and never come back. Or if they do, they're not men any more, but only whites with blue eyes and coal black hands. Why do you think I run south with Stib and Harley and the rest of them fools? Mans thinks he'll fight. The sweet, brave, stubborn man. Like the white walkers were no more than rangers, but what does he know? He can call himself king beyond the wall all he likes, but he's still just another old black crow who flew down from the Shadow Tower. He's never tasted winter. I was born up there, child, like my mother, and her mother before her, and her mother before her, born of the fee folk, we remember."
Usher stood, her chains rattling together.
"I tried to tell your lordling brother only yesterday when I saw him in the yard. My lord Stark, I called to him, respectful as you please. But he looked through me, and that sweaty oaf, Great John Umber, shoves me out of the path. So be it. I'll wear my irons and hold my tongue. A man who won't listen can't hear."
"Tell me. Rob will listen to me, I know he will."
"Will he now? We'll see. You tell him this, my lord. You tell him he's bound on marching the wrong way. It's north he should be taking his swords. North, not south. You hear me?"
Bran nodded. "I'll tell him." But that night, when they feasted in the great hall, Rob was not with them. He took his meal in the Solar instead, with Lord Rickard and the Great John and the other Lord's Bannermen, to make the final plans for the long march to come. It was left to Bran to fill his place at the head of the table and act the host to Lord Karstark's sons and honored friends. They were already at their places when Hodor carried Bran into the hall on his back and knelt beside the high seat. Two of the serving men helped lift him from his basket. Bran could feel the eyes of every stranger in the hall. It had grown quiet. "My lords," Alice Mullen announced. "Brandon Stark of Winterfell." "I welcome you to our fires," Brand said stiffly, "and offer you meat and mead in honor of our friendship." Harryon Carstark, the oldest of Lord Rickard's sons, bowed and his brothers after him. Yet as they settled back in their places, he heard the younger two talking in low voices over the clatter of wine cups.
"Sooner die than live like that," muttered one.
His father's namesake, Eddard, and his brother Torrin said,
"Likely the boy was broken inside as well as out. Too craven to take his own life."
Broken, Bran thought bitterly, as he clutched his knife. Is that what he was now? Bran, the broken?
"I don't want to be broken,"
he whispered fiercely to Maester Lewin, who'd been seated to his right.
"I want to be a knight."
"There are some who call my order the Knights of the Mind," Lewin replied. "You are a surpassingly clever boy when you work at it, Bran. Have you ever thought that you might wear a maester's chain? There is no limit to what you might learn."
"I want to learn magic," Bran told him. "The crow promised that I would fly."
Maester Lewin sighed.
"I can teach you history, healing, herb lore. I can teach you the speech of ravens and how to build a castle and the way a sailor steers his ship by the stars. I can teach you to measure the days and mark the seasons. And at the Citadel in Old Town, they can teach you 1,000 things more. But, Bran, no man can teach you magic."
"The children could," Bran said. "The children of the forest." That reminded him of the promise he had made to Usher in the Godswood. So he told Lewin what she had said. The maester listened politely.
"The wildling woman could give old Nan lessons in telling tales, I think," he said when Bran was done. "I will talk with her again, if you like, but it would be best if you did not trouble your brother with this folly. He has more than enough to concern him without fretting over giants and dead men in the woods. It's the Lannisters who hold your lord father, Bran, not the children of the forest."
He put a gentle hand on Bran's arm.
"Think on what I said, child."
And 2 days later, as a red dawn broke across a windswept sky, Bran found himself in the yard beneath the gatehouse, strapped atop Dancer, as he said his farewells to his brother. "You are the lord in Winterfell now," Rob told him. He was mounted on a shaggy grey stallion, his shield hung from his horse's side, wood banded with iron, white and grey, and on it the snarling face of a direwolf. His brother wore grey chainmail over bleached leathers, sword and dagger at his waist, a fur-trimmed cloak across his shoulders. "You must take my place, as I took father's, until we come home." "I know," Bran replied miserably. He had never felt so little, or alone, or scared. He did not know how to be a lord. "Listen to Maester Lewin's counsel, and take care of Rickon. Tell him that I'll be back as soon as the fighting is done." Rickon had refused to come down. He was up in his chamber, red-eyed and defiant.
"No!"
he'd scream when Bran had asked him if he didn't want to say farewell to Rob.
"No farewell!"
"I told him," Bran said. "He says no one ever comes back."
"He can't be a baby forever. He's a Stark, and near four," Rob sighed.
"Well, Mother will be home soon. And I'll bring Father back, I promise." He wheeled his courser around and trotted away. Grey Wind followed, loping beside the warhorse, lean and swift. Alice Mullen went before them, through the gate, carrying the rippling white banner of House Stark atop a high standard of grey ash. Theon Greyjoy and the Great John fell in on either side of Rob, and their knights formed up in a double column behind them, steel-tipped lances glinting in the sun. Uncomfortably he remembered Usher's words.
"He's marching the wrong way," he thought.
For an instant he wanted to gallop after him and shout a warning, but when Rob vanished beneath the portcullis, the moment was gone. Beyond the castle walls a roar of sound went up. The foot soldiers and townsfolk were cheering Rob as he rode past brand new, cheering for Lord Stark, for the Lord of Winterfell and his great stallion, with his cloak streaming and grey wind racing beside him. They would never cheer for him that way, he realized with a dull ache. He might be the Lord in Winterfell while his brother and father were gone, but he was still Bran the Broken. He could not even get off his own horse, except to fall. When the distant cheers had faded to silence, and the yard was empty at last, Winterfell seemed deserted and dead. Bran looked around at the faces of those who remained, women and children and old men, and Hodor. The huge stable boy had a lost and frightened look to his face. "Hodor," he said sadly. "Hodor," Bran agreed, wondering what it meant. Daenerys. When he had taken his pleasure, Khal Drogo rose from their sleeping mats to tower above her. His skin shone dark as bronze in the ruddy light from the brazier, the faint lines of old scars visible on his broad chest. Ink-black hair, loose and unbound, cascaded over his shoulders and down his back, well past his waist. His manhood glistened wetly. The Khal's mouth twisted in a frown beneath the droop of his long mustachio.
"The stallion who mounts the world has no need of iron chairs."
Dany propped herself on an elbow to look up at him, so tall and magnificent. She loved his hair especially. It had never been cut. He had never known defeat. "It was prophesied that the stallion will ride to the ends of the earth," she said.
"The earth ends at the Black Salt Sea," Drogo answered at once.
He wet a cloth in a basin of warm water to wipe the sweat and oil from his skin.
"No horse can cross the poisoned water."
"In the free cities there are ships by the thousand," Dany told him, as she had told him before, "wooden horses with 100 legs that fly across the sea on wings full of wind." Khal Drogo did not want to hear it.
"We will speak no more of wooden horses and iron chairs."
He dropped the cloth and began to dress.
"This day I will go to the grass and hunt woman-wife," he announced, as he shrugged into a painted vest and buckled on a wide belt with heavy medallions of silver, gold, and bronze.
"Yes, my sun and stars," Dany said. "Drogo would take his blood riders and ride in search of Racha, the great white lion of the plains. If they returned triumphant, her lord husband's joy would be fierce, and he might be willing to hear her out. Savage beasts he did not fear, nor any man who had ever drawn breath, but the sea was a different matter. To the Dothraki, water that a horse could not drink was something foul. The heaving, grey-green plains of the ocean filled them with superstitious loathing. Drogo was a bolder man than the other horse lords in half a hundred ways she had found, but not in this. If only she could get him onto a ship. After the Khal and his blood riders had ridden off with their bows, Dany summoned her handmaids. Her body felt so fat and ungainly now that she welcomed the help of their strong arms and deft hands, whereas before she had often been uncomfortable with the way they fussed and fluttered about her. They scrubbed her clean and dressed her in sand silk, loose and flowing. As Doria combed out her hair, she sent Jiqui to find Ser Jorah Mormont. The knight came at once. He wore horsehair leggings and painted vest like a rider. Coarse black hair covered his thick chest and muscular arms.
"My princess, how can I serve you?"
"You must talk to my lord husband," Danny said. "Drogo says the statue..."